Now Gregory will speak on which Christianity fits Unitarian Universalism.
Well, good morning.
Good morning.
So I already invite argument, which Christianity fits Unitarian Universalism. I must say, I don't know how many of you watched Rick Warren's interviews with the two presidential candidates last night, but I'm going to suggest that the foundation of the questioning process was from a particular Christian perspective, and that there are also other Christian perspectives that were not represented there. And so we ask ourselves, how is it that one Christian perspective can override and essentially become more powerful and have a louder voice in our culture than other Christian perspectives? And I find it, and I always have found it curious that my understanding of Christianity, a religion which I have been religiously groomed in, a religion based on love, based on sacrifice, based on service, could eventually lead to a religion in which military expansion is expected and the norm. That may seem odd. How does love move from service and sacrifice to the expectation we would defend ourselves with military force, or we would be aggressive with military force to maintain a particular way of life? Can you imagine if either one of the candidates would say, well, because of my Christian faith and my belief in a loving God, we're going to withdraw all our troops and we're going to withdraw all the aggressive corporations that we sponsor in this world and bring them into our country and figure out how we can be a more peaceful nation, how many votes they would have gotten on election day? None, but they were representing a particular Christianity. Recently, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, said we need to save the planet environmentally, and a Christian representative, Michelle Buckham from Minnesota, said Jesus has already saved the planet, we don't need to save the planet. And then the next day I'm looking in the paper and it said oceans, dead zones grow. So again, here's a perspective of Christianity that we need to pay attention to. But on the same token, I'm listening to a Christianity that has always struck me as odd since I was 16 and 17 years old, that has been a religion that speaks of love, but nonetheless is based on fear. And I'm beginning to understand the fear, and a lot of times people will talk about fear of hell, fear of doing bad, fear of judgment, fear of God's wrath. And if you believe in a wrathful God and a judgmental God, I suppose that fear is justified because all of us are not going to behave well at all the time. So maybe that is justified. But now we see in Christianity today, popular Christianity, or media Christianity, I may say, we see a fear of existence, a fear of the termination of the religion Christianity, a fear that there is another religion that has in its mind the destruction of this religion Christianity and the elimination of it on the face of the planet so another religion can take its place. And at first we might think that's really off the wall and that's kind of odd. However, Christianity is a religion that was born out of trauma. In what I'm trying to get to with born out of trauma is if you've ever struggled with a trauma in your own life and working through a trauma in your own life, have you had trouble seeing before the trauma? Do you ever get stuck in the trauma? Does the trauma ever produce enough feelings to drive your behavior and really you begin to organize your life around the trauma itself? Psychologically, a lot of us humans do that. Christianity was born, or in the story, has its founder crucified, executed by the state, for espousing beliefs contrary to the state. Trauma. Christianity in the first century was a persecuted religion. Trauma. Christianity began to grow, and in the second century, toward the end of the second century, one of the Roman emperors decided that they were going to eliminate Christianity from the empire. And that's where you hear the stories of feeding Christians to lions and putting and crucifying many Christians. Trauma. The elimination of Christianity was the intention of the emperor. Christianity was a religion that is trauma anchored into its roots. It makes sense to me now that there would be a fearfulness in Christianity of its elimination by another group. However, we know that as we work through trauma, and as we can get behind the trauma and move through the trauma and live our life not being directed by the trauma, we can be free from that trauma. And so we ask ourselves, how is it that one of the most powerful groups of people in our country still behave in fear as if trauma is imminent, when indeed it is not imminent? So we can see that there is a Christianity that's problematic, that allows its history, the negative part of its history, to drive it. We even see that within Christianity itself as Unitarians, between the issue between Unitarianism and Trinitarianism. There was a fight in the 3rd and 4th centuries about which is the correct view of Jesus, whether he was totally divine, equal with God, or whether Jesus was created by God, but a special, perfect person, different than anybody else, was basically the argument. Well, when one of the emperor's support for the Unitarians actually died in a battle, and his troops got slaughtered in the battle, the Trinitarian emperor rose to full power and said, yes, we're Trinitarians. And at that particular point, the Trinitarians murdered a lot of people who were Unitarians and called it heresy and began to murder. Again, trauma and fear of its very existence. I'm suggesting as a result of that, we can begin to understand that that particular type of Christianity went into a process of creating a self-belief system that was exclusionary of other belief systems, even other types of Christianity. So here we have this man, Jesus, and 300 years later, we have this group of people that's saying Jesus was divine and equal with God. What that did was that completely separated that brand of Christianity from everything else. It separated it from Judaism, it separated it from paganism, and it separated it from the Muslim religion. It created an exclusionary process, and if you weren't this, then you were against us. If you didn't have these beliefs, you are against us. And what we see in that is a Christianity that's exclusionary, problematic. We see that in the movement, Unitarian movement, in the beginning of this nation. There was a time when William Ellery Channing and Calvinist Christians and Unitarian Christians and Trinitarian Christians could share pulpits. And it was no big deal. But then the Unitarian was elected president of Harvard, and the Calvinists said, they don't believe like us, and then they divided Christianity again within this country, and you had the Unitarians and you had the Trinitarians, you had the Calvinists, and you had those people that followed Channing and eventually Emerson, Thoreau, and Margaret Fuller, and you saw a divide. And again, you can see this brand of Christianity moving to an exclusionary process. If you are not like us, you are other than us, and that's a problem if you are other than us. That's one type of Christianity. I'm going to suggest today that to understand Christianity and to work with the Christianity that we Unitarian Universalists were born from, a Christianity that we Unitarian Universalists claim in our list of traditions, a Christianity that is in our heritage, to really fully understand that, we must begin in the beginning of the teachings of that man Jesus. We must begin pre-trauma. Our faith tradition can't be based on the trauma. We must move back, and I'm going to suggest to fully understand Christianity as Jesus taught Christianity, we must understand the temptation story. We must understand the beginning of when that teacher made the decision that he was going to teach a particular way and a particular message, and he was not going to deviate from that message, but he was going to be true to that message. And if you remember, or not, the temptation story, as Jesus was baptized by John the Baptist, he is compelled to go up into the wilderness by the Spirit of God and be tempted by Satan for some reason, to find out if he was true. Actually, I don't know why reason, just says he was compelled to make the decisions about his ministry. And what I want to be clear about this man Jesus, that I think this Christianity is acceptable to Unitarian Universalism, he, as the story is told, puts himself in community, puts himself in a faith tradition that you cannot pull him out of that faith tradition and make sense of him. You cannot say he's divine and separate from the universe and separate from humanity and other than who we are as a community of people. He goes up and he goes out into the desert, and the devil comes and talks to him, and he says, "If you are the Son of God, tell these stones to become bread." And what Jesus says at that point in response to the tempter, "It is written." Jesus doesn't say, "I am the Christ, I am divine, and I have power over you, and therefore you have to go away." What Jesus does is he calls on his faith tradition in his moment of testing, in his trial, in his moment of stress. He calls on that faith tradition to be able to stand in the present to deal with what he's got to deal with at that particular point in time. He's not alone. He's got a faith tradition of 1,000 years behind him. And it's very important, I think, to recognize which part of that faith tradition he calls on. And he calls on that part of the faith tradition where I think we Unitarian Universalists sometimes have difficulty, where God commands him and his followers to be obedient. Now, can you imagine a Unitarian Universalist preacher standing up here and saying, "You are commanded to be obedient to a certain set of values," and not say, "Wait a minute, what are you commanding this commandment?" We've kind of bypassed this commandment process that Jesus is referring to. What Jesus is referring to is a relationship with a set of values that no matter what he is about personally, no matter where he comes from in his own personal history, no matter what traumas he has come through, no matter what dysfunction he comes through, no matter what family role, scapegoat, hero, lost child, he plays, no matter what is about him personally, he says, "I am called to be obedient to this particular value system that's bigger than me and that has traveled through time, and I find myself in that faith lineage, and that's who I am and that's where I am, and when I'm at my weakest, I lean on that faith tradition. I do not lean on myself." That's what he's saying. And he says, "Remember how the Lord God led you through the wilderness in these days 40 years. Remember." So he is gaining strength from an event that occurred 1,000 years ago. How does that happen? How does he go back 1,000 years and gain strength from an event? and bring it into the here and now, that when he's facing his temptation, he calls upon that event, and that gives him strength to stand and be true to his own self. The second temptation, again, the devil took him and said, "If you are the Son of God, if you are the Son of God, throw yourself down, for it is written." And I find that curious, because now here we have in the tradition, Christian tradition, the evidence that Satan also uses the Bible to manipulate us. Do we see that in our culture today? Yes, sure we do. And Jesus says, "Throw yourself down." And Jesus says, answered him, "For it is written, do not put your Lord God to the test." And again, when you look at the scripture in the book of Deuteronomy where Jesus is anchoring himself into something that happened 1,000 years ago, it where the words say, "Be sure to keep the commandments of the Lord. Be sure to keep the stipulations and do what is right in the Lord's sight." And it goes on and says, in the future, in that same passage that Jesus is referring to, in the future when your children ask you, what is the meaning of the stipulations? What is the meaning of keeping these commandments? When your children ask you this, see, this is how the 1,000 years ago event can have meaning and power in the here and now. When your children ask you, you tell them the story. When we were slaves of Pharaoh in Egypt, the Lord brought us out of Egypt with His mighty hand and He set us free. So now, Jesus is remembering what it means to be enslaved. Jesus is remembering what it means to have somebody in an act of tyranny over you, robbing you of your life so that you have to labor for the benefits of others. And he is remembering deliverance from that. And in remembrance, deliverance from that tyranny, and remember, as Jesus is speaking, he is living in an occupied state by an empire who is demanding them to behave a particular way because they don't have power in that state. I guess in an odd way, if you were to fight against the Roman Empire at that time, you'd be an insurgent. I don't know. But they were in an occupied state. And so again, Jesus places himself in a tradition. When he's stressed, when he's troubled, he calls upon that tradition to strengthen him, to help him get through. The next temptation. And the devil took him up on a high mountain, and he showed him the world and the splendor, and he said, "I will give you all this." And again, Jesus says, "For it is written, serve your God only. Serve your God only, it is written." What Satan offered Jesus, I think, is extremely important when we're talking about which Christianity and the variety of Christianities we have, that in this particular temptation, to understand that whatever Satan symbolizes, whatever the devil symbolizes, whatever that is, whatever would move us from not being our best selves, whatever would move us off of a track where we would normally do the right thing, whatever that is, that's what Satan and that's what the devil represent in this story. Whatever that is, whatever is your temptation, whatever it is, if you're trying to break a habit and that voice says, go ahead and do it, or you're trying to break a habit and your mind numbs out the voice that tells you not to do it, so you're free to do it, and then after you've done it, you deal with your shame. You deal. Whatever that is, that's what this is referring to, because the temptation story is moving to get this man, Jesus, not to be his truest self, is what's happening there. So he says to him, "I will give you rule of all the kingdoms of the world. I will make you the most powerful king that has ever existed." Now, a lot of in my experience in the church, we gloss over that and we move on from that. But if we back up for a minute and ask the question, what would it take to be the most powerful king on the earth. Today, what would it take for me to be the most powerful king on this planet? I would clearly have to dominate all the lands where the oil is. I would have to clearly be in control of the factories that make the instruments that keep people under repression. For me to be king, I would have to do that. And here's Satan robbing me of my free choice of life, robbing me of my civil liberties, right? I have that kind of person. And here is Satan saying to Jesus, I'll put anybody on the Supreme Court you want me to put on the Supreme Court. I'll give you whatever it is you want. When you speak your command, people will move. And I can do that for you. I can't make sense out of, I will make you the most powerful king that ever existed, unless I understand, how could that possibly come about? To be that kind of king. Some of us don't like kings over top of us. No matter who that king is, we don't like kings telling us how to live, where to live, what to do. We have a value of freedom and a value of free choice. So I would want to be able to say no to whatever king I had, Jesus or not Jesus. Doesn't matter to me. But Satan is saying, I can give you that. There's a Christianity that defers power and is free from the quest of power and moves in the direction of kindness and moves in the direction of meeting the needs of the least of these. There is that Christianity. There is also a Christianity, and that Christianity to me is based on the teachings of Jesus. There is also a Christianity that's based on the fear of elimination and persecution that we see in the second and the third and the fourth centuries that became foundational to that Christian way of thinking. And that is a Christianity that is popular today, which is an anathema to Unitarian Universalist. I was watching that program last night, and both candidates have said at one time or another, we will hunt down and kill Bin Laden. Both have said that. My religious sensibilities, and I'm not saying I'm for or against that, but my religious sensibilities of love and peace respond to that, and I'm glad for that. I'm glad I have that. Then I have to put my rational mind into gear to try to make sense of the world in which I live. But I would not be brash and bold about that. If it needs to be done, then it needs to be done. Let's have some sensibility and some humility and some grief and some struggle inside about doing something that's against our religious sensibilities, not something we brag about and glorify in. That's another type of Christianity. When Jesus refers to the Scriptures in Deuteronomy, and He says, for it is written, for it is written, for it is written, obey your God. God promises you land. God will remove people from that land so you can have that land. That's in part of that same Scripture. I could read that and say, oh, God's going to move people off the land so I can have the land. However, in chapter 5, that's chapter 6, 7, and 8 that Jesus is referring to in that temptation. However, in chapter 5 of Deuteronomy, you have a set of principles that are set down. And in those principles, they are the foundation of the rest of what Jesus is saying. So as Jesus refers to Deuteronomy, whatever He's saying about Deuteronomy 6 and using that to sustain Him and to help Him, there are boundaries around what He can say and what He do, and those boundaries are set by those principles in chapter 5. We have our seven principles, and here are 10 principles in chapter 5 of the book of Deuteronomy. They are the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not commit murder, thou shalt not commit adultery, thou shalt not covet. I mean, there's a whole bunch. Thou shalt be on guard within your imagination so that you put no other God before me. No matter how you want to interpret that, what those principles are saying, pay attention to what's going on in your mind and make sure your mind is structured so that you can carry out these principles. That's what that's saying. Have no other God before me. Pay attention to what's going on within yourself and in your mind. I was thinking about particularly the verse that says, "Do not covet your neighbor's wife or husband." To keep it up to date, do not set your desire on your neighbor's house, your neighbor's land. Do I look out my window and see that my neighbor's house is under foreclosure and I think, oh good, I can go get it cheap now and start my own empire? These principles say no to that. Jesus said no to political power that would be oppressive. So is that a kind of Christianity? I'm thinking about that, and then I read the headlines. Now Wall Street wants your pension too. Just like it got the housing funds. So that our society, we see, is based on the opposite of these principles that Jesus is based in. So, if we're looking for a value system that comes out of the religious faith, the Christian religious faith, that we can say yes to as Unitarian Universalists, we are automatically setting ourselves up over and against the values of our culture that we live in today. Our economic system, based on growth, means I have a desire for other than what I have. Well, I need to think about how that comes about. But here comes this value. Do not lust, do not desire for that which is not yours. And then I think about the hardness of what we consider commandments. And then I think about the softness of Christianity that we miss today in a popular Christianity. I think about the words in John 14. And in John 14, 15, 16, and 17 in the Gospel of John, Jesus is talking to his followers and he knows he's going to go into Jerusalem. And he knows that he's going to die or most likely die. He knows that. So in John 14, he begins to speak of words of comfort. He says, "I go to prepare a place for you. I know you're upset. I know you're feeling sorrowful. But I go to prepare a place for you. And if I don't go, the Spirit of comfort can't come and be nurturing to you and guide you to truth." So here comes this other part of this Christianity that's really stringent on being within the boundaries of those 10 principles. And it's this, that within us, the promise that there is a place for you, and you think about Helen's meditation, that no matter what we go through, no matter where we stand, no matter what we do, no matter what troubles we have, that within our minds, within our hearts, there's a sanctuary. There's a place that we can go to and find rest and find peace and be at ease. And that's a value I like about that form of Christianity. That it's not always about aggression. It's not always fearful. It's not always fearful that somebody's trying to eliminate who we are, or somebody's trying to aggress upon me. It's not always that I got to do something to be good or face some sense of disobedience and judgment. There, in this other form of Christianity, there's a stopping and a breathing and an anxiousness place that I can go to. For the founder of that religion says, there is a place for you, where anxiety does not exist, and where you will be comforted and you will find sanctuary. So there is this other kind of Christianity that's got a hardness to it. Follow these commandments, and what is the goodness that this life has to offer will come to you in following these commandments. And there's a hardness to that. And then on the other side over here, you have this teaching. No matter where you go, no matter what you do, no matter what troubles you have, you can stop and breathe and go to a place in you that's peaceful and that's restful and that's easy. And you need to go there to gain the strength to survive in this world and to be in this world. And my conclusion is, the Christianity that we Unitarian Universalists could own, as odd as it may seem, is an honest, biblical Christianity. That's a Christianity we can use. Not one that has layers and layers and layers of history and interpretation and cultural accommodation, but one where we take the story of the nation of Israel and the teachings of Jesus and see the deliverance of that story and see the need to be within a boundary value system, but also to know the comfort of our hearts and the anxiousness of who we are as a people. And we have that balance between purpose and comfort. And that's a biblical Christianity, as odd as it may seem.